We've spent a lot of hours talking about the family. Friday and Saturday, we talked about the husband-wife relationship. We have given today to the parent-child relationship. This morning, we talked about some basic principles in the art of being a parent, skills and secrets, I call it. And we talked about the concept of authority, absolute obedience to absolute authority, the purpose of discipline, the role of discipline in the mind of the child, and the balance between discipline, strong discipline, and expressed love, which in my opinion is the foundation of child raising, the proper balance of strong discipline and expressed love. And those two come together in the principle that because I love you, you must obey me. They are part of the same thing. They are not enemies. Love disciplines, and discipline loves. What I want to do tonight is just to talk about a series of isolated subjects, which are sort of filling in the cracks in this concept of family life, various secrets and skills. One of the things, and I want to begin by adding a footnote to this thing of authority. I believe in authority. As I told you before, the basic rule at our house is that I'm daddy and you're not. And you like me or not or agree with me or not, I have the responsibility for my family. My wife does not have the responsibility. I do, the ultimate responsibility. Therefore, I'm in charge. And I'm the king and I wear the crown. But Brother Heavy rests the crown. I'd like many times to give the crown to someone else. And by the way, one of the reasons why we are in a leadership crisis in America. This is an age of weak men. Men have not only surrendered the home to the wife, they've surrendered it to the children. The church is surrendering leadership of the church to the women, and women don't want it. Our nation is surrendering its leadership, and the reason men are giving up their authority is they do not want their responsibility.
That's right.
You got that? Men just don't want the responsibility. And the responsibility is ours. Now, but if we're going to be authoritarian, I'm not afraid of that word, we have to learn to be honest. And so we must get over, we men, what I call the Sinai complex. You know, it's one thing to be the head of the house, it's something to think you're God. I learned this from counseling troubled teenagers. They would say predictable things, and I've already talked about a couple of those things. Remember I said they would say, yes, my parents love me, but they don't like me? And one of the things that teenagers would say who were not getting along with their parents, they would say, my dad thinks he's God. My dad thinks he's God. And let me ask another question. Again, I do not want to see a show of hands, but I'd like to know, how many of you, especially the men, can ever remember your father apologizing to you? Saying he was sorry, asking your forgiveness, saying he was wrong. If we are going to be a strong authority figures, if we're going to exercise biblical authority, we have to learn honesty, because we are going to blow it. We are going to mess up. And so I call this the Sinai complex. The Sinai complex, that's a fellow who thinks everything he says is engraved in stone, cannot be changed, and cannot be wrong. Kind of like God, he sits up there on Mount Sinai and blesses everyone around him with his Jehovistic pronouncements, and he never backs off. And let me tell you, you're going to have to learn that. And so fathers, strong fathers, have to learn to say three things. Number one, to say, I don't know. I don't know. When my oldest daughter, when she began to go through the teenage years, she'd say, Daddy, should I do this? I'd say, I don't know. This is your first time to be a teenager. It's my first time to be the father of a teenager. We're gonna work on this project together, girl. And often you have to, and a kid will buy this. You say, I think you have to do it this way, and I may be wrong. I don't know. But we're going to try it my way, because I'm the daddy and you're not. And so, and if I'm wrong, we'll talk about it, and we'll try something else. I don't know. Listen, if you don't know, say you don't know. It doesn't mean you don't have that you can't make decisions. It means that you don't have to be God. Second thing we need to learn to say is, I was wrong. I was wrong. And I'm sorry. Let me ask you this, Dad. Did you ever blow your stack before you got the full story? Say yes. Or did you ever kill a mouse with a cannon? You had a bad day? Did you ever spank a kid when you shouldn't have? What do? Bluff your way through? I'll tell you, your kids will lose respect for you. They'll lose respect. Listen, if you've messed up, say so. And many times I've had to go to a kid who's crying and say, look, I'm sorry. I was angry. I was tired. I overreacted. Will you forgive me? Listen, if you are an honest father and an honest mother, there will be many times in your life when you're going to have to ask your kids to forgive you when you mess up. And you better do it, because that's a part of reality and honesty. I remember one night I came home and the kids had gotten something. I forgot what it was. And I had a bad day. I mean, I leveled the countryside. I grounded the whole family, the dog, and two of the neighbors. I mean, I grounded them for the next 40 years. You know, I just really let them have it and said all kinds of stupid things and blew my stack. And you can always tell when you've done that because it gets real quiet in the house. And your wife knows you made an idiot of yourself, but she's afraid to tell you. She'll tell you later, you know. And we came to supper, and there was this dead silence over the table. Everybody's sitting there eating rigatoni, you know, and just absolute holy silence. And I recall I lifted my head and I said to the kids, did you all notice that when I came in the front door tonight that I made a complete jackass out of myself? My oldest daughter said, who was the mouthy one? The Angela, who was about 14 at the time, she said, yes, Father, we noticed that. I said, well, we're going to have to. I said, all bets are off. Let's go back to go and start again. You have to do that. You got that? Because if you don't, your kids will despise you. That is, they will not. They'll lose respect for you. Listen, don't act like you're God, Father. Because you're not. And the father who thinks he's God will not gain an authority. He'll lose it. Okay? That's just that's kind of a footnote to the study on authority. Lose the Sinai complex if you've got it. And if you're wrong, say so. If you need forgiveness, ask for it. And if you don't know, say you don't know. It will not decrease your authority. It will increase it. Next thing I want to talk about is devotions in the home. You understand? I'm just having a series of isolated studies now. And we'll just go to we'll take a break and then we'll go again for the rest of the evening. What about the religious life in the home? There are two approaches to this, and it's a matter of taste, and it's a matter of the chemistry in the family. All families are different. What about family devotions? Well, some people do very well having more or less formal devotions, regular time when the family gathers together, and when you read scripture and pray together and sing, or perhaps read little booklets, and this is very fine. Some people can make that work very well. It works better when the children are small, when everybody eats at the same time and you have control of the situation. When the kids get older, they're coming in at all hours and going at all hours, and it gets more difficult. We, in our family, we have never been successful in regular scheduled family devotions because as soon as we get them scheduled, something would always mess them up 3 or 4 days out of the week. And I'm a preacher, I try not to make our family devotions another church service. It's my opinion, and I may be wrong about this, and you just make up your own mind, and if you disagree, you may be right. It's my opinion, it's a mistake, in most homes at least, to make a family devotions and a mini worship service. But you think about that. If it works for you, okay. But however we do it, and here's my point, regardless of whether we have formal family worship or informal, we always had in our evening meals together, we'd hold hands and sing and pray together, and I didn't preach normally. And they didn't want me to. And yet, regardless of how we structure our family devotions, there is one element, there's one principle that must be observed if we are going to be a godly family. And that is this, that God must be a natural, intrinsic part of our family. That is, God cannot be an artificial add-on. And nothing will turn our kids off to Christ any quicker than having our home life one reality and our Christianity another reality in another department, as another kind of thing. And so we, my wife and I, try very much to make God a part of our lives. We pray about everything. And some problem comes up, we pray about it. My wife has one of the most dynamic prayer lives of anyone I've ever met. My wife gets more prayers answered. She's got an in with God. I think she got it from her daddy. But my wife, God likes my wife. I'm very serious about that. I kid you not. About 2 years ago, we were just sitting at the supper table, and we'd had some very special prayer requests or prayer items, and we were just talking about how God, in some amazing ways, had answered prayers. And my oldest son, who's the smart aleck, said, "Mom, while you're on a roll, how about a Porsche?" Well, he was kidding, of course, I think. Hope he was. Never thought about that. But anyway, my wife, well, in the morning, you've got a kid. You know, kids face pressures in school. You got a kid who's going off to school, and he's got a big thing that day, a big exam, or he's got some kind of situation that causes him to be afraid. My wife will go in and pray with him before they go to school. When you understand that, just go in and say, "Let's talk to God about this. Bring God into it." And we try to make God as much a part of our life as any member of the family. He's there. It's a very natural part. We talk to God. We pray to God. We expect God to answer our prayers. And we belong to God. You understand? It's not simply some separate kind of artificial devotion, but it's got to be in the very warp and woof of our lives. Otherwise, our kids are not going to buy it. You understand that? They're not going to buy it. And if we have a spiritual heritage, we need to pay attention to our children and pass it on. Now, my wife comes from a long line of missionaries and her family, preachers. Not my side of the family, but my wife's side of the family. She has aunts and uncles who have been pioneer missionaries all over the world, Japan, Tibet. She has an uncle that's buried in China on the Tibetan border. And we had at the Florida Christian Convention last year, which was combined with the National Missionary Convention. They all came in, and so we just marked out an afternoon at my wife's sister's home, and we got all the relatives there, the veterans who are coming to the end of their lives, and serving God. And we got my children lined up and a couple of other cousins, and we had a meeting lasted all afternoon. And the purpose was for these veteran saints to tell our kids what they wanted them to know, and we taped it. And we had a beautiful afternoon. We all snot and blue. we spent the afternoon crying, but I think it was profound. Here's a lady Isabel. You ever heard of Isabel Dittemore? Missionary for years and years in China and Tibet and Formosa. And I wanted her to tell my kids directly what she wanted them to hear. I said, "Okay, here are my kids. You talk to them and tell them." You know, as a result of that meeting, my youngest son is planning on being a missionary in Japan. I don't know if he'll follow through with that. He's pretty young, but he's going to do something. And they cried, they wept, and they... I want our children not to have a sense of their spiritual heritage. Look, kids, we're Christians. No matter what it costs, we're Christians. This is how we operate. My point is that God must be real and natural in our lives. Not something we step out of family life to have. You understand? Our religion must not be an add-on. Well, I hadn't said that very well, but however we structure our family's devotional life, that's the principle that I teach. You might have any questions. This is not a sermon. You might have any questions or comments. Feel free to raise your hand and we'll listen to you. I always learn as much as I teach, I think, some of these sessions. You're all a closed mouth bunch. I never saw you. Your preacher must really intimidate you. Next thing I want to talk about is the difference between closeness and dependence. I believe families ought to be close, but one of the common mistakes that parents make, especially mothers, by the way, and they don't mean to make it, is that they, in trying to have a close family, they have a dependent family, and those are two separate things. Let me teach you the difference. Closeness is just that, a family that is close. Dependence is where children never really grow up and take responsibility for their own lives. You got that? That's my definition of dependent children. They never grow up and take responsibility for their own lives. I know people who are 40 and 50 years old who are still children. They still look to their parents. They're still alive for the important decisions. Not that we don't listen to our parents, but that is they turn over the control of their lives to their parents and leave it there. Dependence. And remember I said, I taught us the principle of stewardship. Our kids are not ours. They are God's. We are raising God's kids. And they're to be raised for Him. And if it means that my youngest son has to go to the mission field and I'll not see him for a year or two at a time, that is the way it has to be. And that's going to kill me. But you see, he's God's boy. And I just raised him for God, best I could. And I think we'll be close, no matter where he is. I learned this from my wife's family. They're very close. Often don't see each other, but they're very close. But I know families that spend almost every waking hour together, and all they do is fight. They're not close. They're just dependent. And we have to make our children not. We cannot make our children afraid of life. And this is a very common mistake, and we don't mean to make it because I, you understand, I'm not judging or criticizing tonight. I'm trying to explain. One of the greatest things in life is to be needed. We need to be needed. In fact, we have that written on our forehead right next to 666, and I want to be loved. I want to be needed. There's a song in the musical Oliver, and this young woman has put up with this bum of a fellow, and somebody asks her why she puts up with him, and she sings this song, "Because He Needs Me." And one of the lines of that song is, "If you are lonely, then you will know if someone needs you, you love them so." It's a great thing to be needed. And one of the great joys of having children is they need us. It gives a sense of identity. We are important. Why? Because our children need us. But hear me, we do not have the right to perpetuate the childhood of our children, to make them dependent just so they'll always need us, so we'll always feel needed. And we can do it without ever meaning to do it. Understand? We don't think it through. And it starts from the very young. It's a part of it. So we must not protect our children from life too much. And this is hard. I was talking to a family here before church. One of the hardest things to do is to know where to draw the line between protecting your family, protecting your children, and overprotecting them. I have a friend who's got a couple of children, got a fine young man for a son, except that his wife had a very rough upbringing, and she set as her single mission in life to protect her children from pain of any kind. Pain of failure, pain of rejection, physical pain. And as a result, my friend has a son who's afraid of life. He, frankly, is a sissy. And I don't think he'll ever amount to much because he'll never try very much. You see, you never accomplish anything in life unless you do something once in a while you're afraid to do. Don't you? You have to take chances. We have to let our children fail and fall and be hurt sometimes. And that's hard, and it's especially hard on mothers. It really is. So the temptation is to build a wall about them. We'll be the wall, and we'll keep the wall there, and we'll protect them. If it's going to hurt them, don't let them do it. If they're going to run for an office in school, they can't possibly win. Oh, no, you'll get your feelings hurt. Don't do it. Pull out. Quit. I just got a phone call. I called my wife this morning. I'm that way, you know. I get away from home about the third day. I start getting crazy, you know. I'll just tell you, I'm not worth much without my wife. And I was really fortunate to bless this weekend because I had a really good excuse to call her. I was changing my flight schedule. Otherwise, I'd have had to call her like I normally do and ask her how the geraniums are doing, how's the weather. Anyway, if you're in love, you know how that works. And forgot what I was going to say. Oh yes, my oldest son. He had an election last week. He ran for this, a student representative the senior representative of the student council. And he won. He had a big poster. Spent all last weekend making him. He won. That's great. I figured he'd win. My second son, he ran for president. He's in junior high school. He ran for president of the junior class. He never had a chance. He knows he didn't have a chance. Just before I left, and he said he's going to run anyway. And he might have said to him for a while, I said, "Adam, you're my kind of man. I like a man who gets in fights he knows he can't win." Because if you go into ministry, that's your job. The kingdom man, that's what I said to him, the kingdom man belongs in battles he knows he can't win. But you see, it doesn't take a man to enter a battle he knows he can win. A coward can do that. I'll give you an illustration of this principle, and this is a, may seem a small thing, but but the principle is tremendous. You know, little boys, and I speak much from the man's point of view, but the motto in our house is, go for it. Try it. Won't hurt you. If you lose, you lose. You're not a loser. Oh, everybody loses. Try it. Try anything once. And boy, you must see an unhappy person. You see a girl tried out for cheerleader and didn't make it. You talk about misery. Sackcloth and ashes. Grinding and gnashing of teeth, that's it. And my second daughter, boy, you talk about unhappy. She tried out for cheer and didn't make it and wept. And she stood out by the backyard and she wore off the grass next to a piece of chain link fence and jumped blisters on her feet, learning how to jump and do it. And the next year she made it. But she had a year of tears before she had the joy. And I never forget when I took her out to eat when she made it, and we had a big family celebration. We like family celebrations. Why? She made it. A lot of things she failed at. But you see, if they're going to live, you can't protect them from failure. And this is sort of a parable. I remember the time my little boys were out to, they're getting the age where they and their friends were out riding bicycles. In front of our house, the street is only a block long, so there's not much traffic, and they got out there riding. And you know, little boys do not ride bicycles. You know what I said? They'll ride bicycles once around the block, and then they slide bicycles. They ride them on one wheel, you know. They jump bicycles. They skid bicycles, you know. They put four men on a bicycle. You don't just ride a bicycle, you know. And my two sons and the oldest friends, they were out front, and they'd had some boards and some ramps, and they were jumping them. Who could jump? And they'd rear back and go over these ramps, you know. And my wife said, "Roger, look what they're doing. Go out and stop them." I said, "Why?" They said, "Because they're going to get hurt." I said, "No, I'm not going to stop them." They had a birthday coming up, and we were due to buy bicycles because the one they had was a little thing, beginner's bike. So I said, "What I'm going to do, I'm going to get them a couple of good bikes." And I did, a couple of Schwinn bikes, that long frame, heavy spokes, made for jumping. I said, "I'm going to buy them a couple of bikes that are reasonably safe, and you're going to look the other way." You understand? Because little boys have to try things they're afraid to do, try to outdo their friends. And she said, "But they'll get hurt." And I said, "Exactly. I got Blue Cross." And the hospital is only half a mile away. Now listen to me. And so I got the bikes, and they built the ramps. And did they really get hurt? Absolutely. I mean, it was just about every 3 weeks. I'd take them up there for some stitches, you know. They look like a patchwork quilt, you know. But listen, there are worse things than stitches. Being a coward is one of them. Being afraid of life is another. And life is like, you see, if you understand what I'm saying, I'm not talking about jumping bicycles. I'm talking about challenging life. You see, the church has enough cowards in it. We don't need any more. And we need to raise up our children to be men and women who will have the courage to stand for Christ. Because if I know what I'm paid to teach, the day is going to come when the ranks of the church are about to be thinned out. And the faint of heart aren't going to make it. And so we must let our children grow up to be their own people. We must encourage them to take responsibility for their own lives. There's a difference between being close and being dependent. Have I said enough? You got that point? Our time is getting away from us. And we need to pray to God for the wisdom to know the difference. Well, you think about that anyway. Next thing I want to talk about is some general wisdom for the parent. I want to talk there are many things we're not going to have time to talk about. And let me pick out two or three here. I'll go a few more minutes and then we'll take a short break. As we deal with our children, we must take a child seriously. Never step on what a child thinks or does. So we may attack what a child does. We must never attack what a child is. Many parents think, and they're taught, modern psychologists think, and I know this, I read the books, say that it's very bad for a parent to get angry at a child. That is absolutely silly. It doesn't work anyway. But it's okay to get angry at what a child does. That's legitimate, and they expect it. It is not right to get angry at what a child is. So there's a difference between saying to a child, why do you be such a slob? How can you look at your room? Looks like an explosion in the back room of the Goodwill factory. Boy, when you get married, you're going to have a miserable time of it. I didn't raise you to be a slob. What's your problem? But, you know, you're attacking a child's character. And that's wrong. You can't do that. But it's legitimate to go in there and you can shout, raise your voice. In fact, it's better sometimes. I think there's a lot more to be said for terror than has been admitted. Say, look, I get very angry when I tell you to do something, when I tell you to clean your room and I walk in and find that you haven't done it. Son, do you know how hard it is on your old man to be ignored? I get angry at being ignored. I get angry when I expect you to do something and you don't do it. Listen, that's legitimate. I haven't attacked his character. I've just got a right to be angry. And you can really blow your stack if you want to. Go ahead, be my guest. But attack what a child does, don't attack their character. I've heard parents scream at children in the supermarket, why do you have to be so bad? How do I get stuck with you? I've heard fathers say to their teenage sons, you never amount to anything. You're never going to amount to anything. Why? Look what you're doing. See, you're not building a child, you're destroying a child. And give legitimacy to what a child thinks. Never step on what a child thinks. It's like, you got a large family. You always, when your wife cooks, always something one kid doesn't like. You know, Daddy, I don't like spinach. Of course you like spinach. Don't be silly. Everybody likes spinach. Oh, made me throw up last time. I don't work out the idea. You know, it's one thing not to like spinach. It's something else to be stupid for not liking spinach. You don't say, don't be silly. Of course you like spinach. You say, and this is this practical? You say, look, of course you don't like spinach. A lot of things I don't like. But in a big family, you got to eat what you don't like sometimes. And there's things I don't like and things you don't like. And eat your spinach. You understand? At least you're not silly. That's fine. You know, bedtime's a sore point in many families. When children are little and you got company, they want to stay up. Daddy, can I stay up? Don't be silly. You know you can't stay up. Why do you ask a question like that? Go to bed. No. Here's what you say. You say, well, I can see why you'd want to stay up. If I were you, I'd want to stay up. We got company, and you'd really like to stay up, but you know tomorrow's school, and you know how we operate. And I wish you could stay up, but you can't. You're going to have to go to bed. He goes to bed anyway. At least he didn't go to bed stupid. You understand? You know, it's not a sign of insanity to want to stay up when you got company, is it? But you got to go to bed anyway. You understand? The difference is not between going to bed and not going to bed. The difference is between putting a kid down and respecting what he thinks. It's a very important principle. And you can say to the child, yes, I can see why you'd like to do that. I wish you could, but you can't. You can say no without destroying a child's life. You understand that? You can enforce rules without attacking their character, and we simply must. Listen, I said this before, I'll say it again. You turn a kid off, you've got your work cut out for you, turning him back on. And some kids have been turned off and will never be turned on again. And we teach children common courtesy. How to respond in a respectful manner. The rule at our house is you can say anything to us you want to say within reason, as long but you got to lower your voice and smile. You got that? You have a right to say what you want to say to your parents, but you will not talk in that tone of voice. They must respond in a respectful manner. We need to teach our children the common graces. I'll tell you, we have so many kids around today who just aren't. It's not a question of not being civilized or not being Christian. They aren't even civilized. And we need to teach our children the grace of kindness and politeness and the grace of gratitude. Let me just focus on that for a second. One of the grandest lessons we can teach our children is the grace of gratitude. Teach our children to be grateful. And we've grown up, we've never had a lot of things that other families had, although we got by okay. We never had any gripes in that area. But my wife and I have worked very hard to teach our children to be grateful. Somebody does something for you, you write a thank you note. Our kids are writing thank you notes before they could write. My wife would write them, and they'd put an X on them, or slobber on them, or do something, whatever they did. Spill spaghetti on it, some kind of signature. And you say, thank you, and please. You know, my kids, teenagers, if I take them out to eat, they'll thank me. Every one of them, every time. I like that. Thank you, Dad, for taking us out to eat. You know what that makes me want to do? Take them out next time. Simple. Teach children one of the words. For instance, I'm just talking about simple things. Teach our children to call adults by their last names, unless they're a relative. You know, aunt, I don't know what traditions you have in this part of the country. When I was in the local ministry, we had this rule that we do not call adults by their last name unless they're like an aunt or an uncle, and it could be Aunt Dale and Uncle Bill. But you call every adult by their last name, Mr. and Mrs. And you always get these kind-hearted souls in the church who say, oh, let them call me Edith. You know, let them call me Katie, this woman who's 55 years old. And our answer is very kindly, as kindly as we can, no, those are our kids. They'll call you what we say. And we have a rule at our house. You call them by their last name. You understand it? Simple courtesy. There's nothing any more snotty and ugly than a 7-year-old kid calling a 40-year-old man by his first name. He's not related. You understand? It's just common courtesy, common decency. Mr. and Mrs. We have a thing in the South I really like. In the South, children in well-brought-up families use the word sir a lot more than they do up north. Sons will say sir to the fathers. And my boy's got some friends who are Southern boys. And my oldest boy picked up that habit. I haven't taught it to my younger boy yet. I've tried several times, but he gives me the shoulder. You know, he's hard-headed. But my oldest son will respond, yes, sir. Listen, that's good. That's good. Because a man will never be prepared to be respected unless he learns how to respect ahead of time. You start out by giving respect to property. This is biblical, by the way. We're supposed to respect things which have dignity and things which have stature, especially God. And you'd be amazed how far this will take a kid in life, how many doors it will open to them, how much easier it is to like children who say thank you and please and yes, sir. And that isn't hard to do. It just takes a little teaching. That may not seem important to you, but I think it is very, very important. Well, we need to teach our child to speak in a respectful way. The last thing I want to say before we take our break, it's 8:30, and we'll take about a 10-minute break in a few minutes, is to make the home a place where a child is glad to go, where he's glad to bring his friends. And my wife works very hard on this in a number of ways. My wife is a very good housekeeper, but she's not a fastidious housekeeper. She doesn't do windows. I do the windows on the outside. She doesn't do my shirts because I won't let her. I like laundered shirts, and so I take them to laundry. But my wife, the beds are made every morning, the house is dusted every day, the dishes are washed every day, and I like that. I need order in my life. It's very important to a man. It's important to me to come home and find the house in order. I don't care if the windows are pretty clean, or she doesn't wash the bottom of the refrigerator, order. You know, one of the reasons she does it, for a number of reasons. She does it because that's the way she is, even though she's very busy. She does it because she knows I like it, but she also does it because, and listen to this, she wants our children to be able to bring friends home unannounced and not be humiliated. You understand? So our children want to bring friends home from school and come in and have a glass of milk and spend some time. They won't have to worry about what the house is going to look like. Do you realize that? I know teenage kids who would never bring anybody home. Now, sometimes it's serious. Mom or dad might be drunk, but they don't know what kind of shape the house is going to be in. It's just not fair to the kids. We need to make a home a place where they'll bring their friends. And I'll tell you, you'll have a house full of kids. My friends have... We live in a wealthy section of town. We're not right where we live, but north of us. And my friends... We go to Winter Park. My kids go to Winter Park High School, which is the old money in Florida. And it's a very good high school, one of the top ones in the country. That's why we bought our house where we did. We have a lot of friends who have money. And some of them are very fine kids. But a lot of them, their parents gave them things instead of time. And we've had a parade over the last 7 or 8 years, a parade of these through our house. I came home one day, and there were two boys in the living room, neither of which came to see my daughters. They were former boyfriends who came back and talked to my wife. My wife could open a business counseling former boyfriends. And these are nice kids. You know, they come together for a while. And you know why? Because my wife will sit down, and my wife doesn't play games. And if they got a problem, she'll talk to about it. And she'll call things by their first name. And they had a problem. And they needed somebody to talk to. And there she was talking about their dating life and some of their decisions. And the girls had gone to bed. And you get my point? We need to make our house a place where the kids can bring their friends. I don't believe in these houses. And again, this is a matter of taste. You may not agree with me, but I don't believe in these houses that have a room, the living room is a showroom like in a store, and nobody ever goes in. I think houses are for living in. We live in our living room. And the floors are kind of marked up, and the couch is getting a little bit saggy. And the piano is old, and you can't tune it to the full pitch anymore. But that house, if those walls could talk, they'd tell you of a lot of stories about a lot of people, a lot of teenagers who talked about a lot of important things. You see, listen, our young people are going to deal with the important issues of life. The best place to deal with those is at home. But if we don't make the home a place where they can deal with them, they'll deal with them in somebody else's house, or they'll deal with it in the streets, or at the drive-in theater, and we're not going to like some of their solutions. We need to make the home a place. Does that make sense to you? A place where kids can come and be a happy place, a refuge. A place when kids get there, they're glad to be there. Let me ask you this, and again, I don't mean to be unkind, but it's a very sad thing to grow up in a home when the only happy times is when dad's not there. And I dare say as much as 30 or 40% of the people in this building tonight grew up in a home where that was really happy when dad wasn't home. And somebody's going to answer for that. You understand? Home must be a place where kids can live and love and be happy, a refuge, a place where they can bring their friends, a place where they want to go, not just a place where they go when they run out of money or need a place to sleep or they need a meal. And listen, that doesn't happen by accident. The old Hoosier poet said, it takes a heap of living to make a house a home. And I'll tell you, I've been in a lot of pretty houses that were not homes. You understand? You can build a house, but homes don't just happen. And, you know, when we moved to Orlando, we don't move around much. We were 13 years in one church, and we've been in Orlando for about almost, we're not approaching our 10th year. And, when we moved, it was very hard on our children to uproot them. And we told them, and they understood what we were talking. We said, look, we're going to buy a new house. We've already got a home. We're just going to put our home in another house. Kids need to know the difference. Because a house can get battered, and good homes tend to batter houses. But they need to be a home. I don't want to get sentimental about that, but listen. I see kids every day, listen, who don't want to go home. Who don't want to go home. And I can't think of anything more sad than that. Very sad. Well, I've got a few more things to say, and then we'll quit. But next hour, I'll say this, so we'll fill the building. No, we're going to talk about sex education next hour. That'll build a crowd. What do we say to our kids? And I'm not going to get real clinical. I'm not going to get very specific because we have a mixed audience tonight, but I'm going to talk about some general principles that all can hear and need to hear, because listen, this is the big it. If a family does not deal straight on with this issue, it has really not done its job. This is the thing. And so the first of next hour, I'll talk about how we give sex education to our kids. And trust me, I'll not embarrass you. Well, let me rephrase that. Pray for me that I don't embarrass you. Let's take our break.
have some refreshment left? Coffee? Something downstairs? Take a break.
And the way you do it God's way. And it needs to be relaxed, unemotional. We need to choose a good time and place. We need to be direct. We need to give it to them straight. We need to emphasize what is smart. We don't need to preach. And we need to emphasize what I call the long view of sex with our young people. And I'll get to that in a minute. But, and I'm not going into all the details. I will sketch this in broad outlines. But we need to talk to our children. It was my job to talk to the boys, and so I took them on a trip with me when they got near that age. And I'd talked to them about various things before. I recall when my oldest son, Aaron, when he was just about 8 or 9, maybe as young as 7, I don't recall, but he'd gone with me up the street to the Nautilus Club when I worked out, and I wouldn't let him play one of the machines. And he said, "Why, Daddy?" And I said, "Well, because you haven't gone through puberty yet, and you don't have... and you're not ready to lift weights." And he wanted an explanation. So I said, "Well, honey, in a few years you're going to go through what's called puberty, and these things called hormones will be, your body will begin to manufacture hormones, and then you can build muscles. Until you go through that, it's not good for you to lift the weights too much, heavy weights." And I told him a couple other things that would happen to his body. We're walking home. I'm telling him this, and he's listening. He learned this new word, puberty. And he couldn't wait to let his sisters know that he knew the word. And so the next night, he worked it into the conversation at the table. I'd give $100 if I could remember how he worked it in, because it didn't fit. And I about fell off my chair laughing, but he knew, he had heard a word, but he began to know something about it. But when it came time to tell them, I just took them on a trip with me and got them in the car and said, and the first time, you see, I grew up on the farm. I grew up under the myth that farm boys don't need sex education because they see it all and they learn it all. Ha! I saw it all. I had the foggiest notion what I was looking at. I mean... You understand? I was ignorant of sin. We don't assume. And so it took about 2 hours with each boy as they came of age. And I said, "That boy," I said, "Aaron, Adam, I'm going to talk to you about sex." And the first time was hard. Second time was easier. But I'm telling you, it took me 3 weeks to work up my courage. And I teach this stuff. So I'm sympathetic. And I said, "I don't want you to know about sex, but I want you to hear it from your old man. And I want you to hear it straight. And what I recommend is you tell them everything. I mean, the young men need to hear how a woman's body works, what the language means. They need to know about homosexuality, male and female, and what the vocabulary is and what the words mean. I even discuss the dirty words with them. That really surprised them. They'd never heard me use them before, you know. I said, here's the dirty word for it, and this is what the word means. So these kids hear all this. We think they know what they're hearing. We think they know the meaning. They don't. They're confused. So I told them the dirty words, what they meant, and then told them the right words. And you talk about a couple of shocked boys. They never heard me use that language in their life. I guess they figured I didn't know them. You know, I never used them. You know, here's my dad. He can read 6 languages, but he can't read the restroom wall down at the Gulf Station. You know? And I've never used them since. And but it's interesting. In both cases, I found out, I learned a great secret. I was more scared. I thought they'd be nervous and upset, and they weren't. I could have killed them. They were cool. They were cool as a cucumber. You know, "Yeah, Dad." And I'm the one sweating, you know, and shuffling my feet, you know, and getting cotton mouth, you know, the first time around. I just told them everything. Once we got started, it was great. And my oldest son, I remember, had a couple of questions. And you know what he told his mother when he got back home? He said, "You know," he said, "I'm kind of glad Dad talked to me, because I think if I had a question, I could always go to him. Now that it's like opening a door of communication that he can walk through any time he needs to." And we tell them. What do you tell them? What are the kind of things you tell them? Well, there's some things, for instance, a girl needs to hear from their dad. You know, boys and girls are different. We had certain rules at our house. We don't go to R-rated movies. We don't go to drive-ins at all. Why? That's called financing your own misery. Drive-ins are trouble. And we just made a rule, and we just always enforced it. And they buy that. And And I explained to my daughters, I think they need to hear some things from their dad, as I say. And I'm just going to give you some examples of the general approach which I recommend for sex education. I said to my daughters, that first of all, you're a very good-looking young lady, and any guy that looks at you and doesn't get ideas ought to be ashamed of himself. but what he does with those ideas is up to you. And how you, it all depends on what you wear and how you wear it, and how you walk and what you say and how you conduct yourself. You can either be a quality lady or you can be something else. It's up to you. And I said, you need to know that God made us in a certain way. He made us. We can be very spiritual and devout and love Christ and be as religious as Moses. But if you go park somewhere, you go to a drive-in movie and you make out, pretty soon you cross a line. God made us that way. And where the spirit leaves off and chemistry takes over. I call it the gland line, you know. You go beyond a certain point, it's pure, it's not the spirit, it's the glands. And you cross that line, you're not very smart. God made that line for marriage. But I said the thing you need to know is you get to the boy's gland line about twice as fast as you get to yours. You get to his first. So the rule is you stay on this side of his glands. And I taught him how to do it. I said, you keep your hands off of certain parts of the body, and I told him the rules. And told him how to stay on this side of his. You know, it's interesting. And they said, it made sense to that. They want to see a lot of Christian kids get themselves in trouble not because they're evil, but because they never got the information in a form that they could handle it. They just weren't smart. I never forget my oldest daughter, first boyfriend, nice kid, came to the church. Name was Rick, and she was 15, he was 16, And they'd come in at night, you know, and after their date, and we'd let them stay out too late, and they'd pull up in front of the house, sit there about 15 minutes, then she'd come in. After that, she knew I was getting nervous. And I can live with 15 minutes, or 20. 25, I began to get uncomfortable. Anyway, that night they just drove up, and about 2 minutes, she was in the house. And I said, Leandra, did you and Rick have a fight? No, no. I said, well, what happened? You usually sit out in the car and talk for a few minutes. He said, well, he pushed me out of the car. And I said, push you out of the car? Yeah, she said, he pushed me out and said, glands. You see, what had happened was, and I didn't tell her to do this, she went and told him what I told her. She said, Rick, we're going to stay on this side of your glands. And, you know, it made sense to him. They weren't embarrassed. What did we have there? Something evil and dirty? No, we didn't have anything evil and dirty. We had a couple of nice kids playing it smart. And I'm for kids. I think our kids will play it smart if we'll give them half a chance. Listen, I don't buy this Planned Parenthood nonsense which assumes that our daughters are a bunch of tramps. That's the message of Planned Parenthood to our school. They say that our girls are not capable of virtue. Neither are our sons. You understand? Our sons and our daughters are not capable of virtue. Therefore, we got to hand out birth control information and teach them how to get an abortion. We have to do that. Why? Because they're gonna mess around anyway, and so we can't stop them. And therefore, we're gonna try to clean up after them. And I don't buy that. Our young people are capable of virtue.
Amen.
Our young ladies are not trash, and our young men do have honor and self-control if we just give them half a chance. And I think I don't let the Planned Parenthood tell my daughters that. But you understand what I'm saying? I'm for teenagers. I think they're great, and I think they get in trouble sometimes. But usually it's because we haven't taught them how to be smart. Our kids want to be smart. They don't want to mess up their lives. If we need to give the information in a form that they can handle it. And we need to tell our young people and this is one of the most important lessons, we need to tell our young people that the teenage years is not time out. See, that's the myth, and it's a cultural myth. The idea is this, that somehow the years between 14 and 20 don't really count. That you can be one thing between 14 and 20. As soon as you turn 21, then you enter real life, then you're going to belong to the church, and then you're going to do certain things. But somehow, teenage years, that's when you're entitled to sow your wild oats, is the old statement. That's his time out, kind of. And let me tell you, it is not time out. It is not time out.
Listen, there is no 4 or 5 or 6 year period that affects your life any more than those years. What you are from 21 to 60 is largely determined by what you are between 14 and 20. And our kids, and they're being lied to. And we need to teach our kids to take the long view of sex. You recall what I told you this morning in another connection. I told my boys, all the rest of their life, they're going to shave. And they're going to shave a quality person, they're going to shave a jerk. Look them right in the eye in the mirror every morning. And I need to teach our kids that the past has a way of coming up behind us on cat feet at the worst moments and saying, boo, remember me? One of my favorite stories comes from a fellow called Charlie Shedd. He tells about a friend of his who was doing beach evangelism back and down in Fort Lauderdale when that was the center of the spring break crowds. And he was walking down the beach, and here came this young college student, great big fellow, football type, and he had a T-shirt on. And they have the dirtiest T-shirts down there during those spring breaks. And it said, help stamp out virginity. What do you say to a guy like that? Help stamp out virginity. The guy said he prayed for wisdom, and he approached the guy, and he said, hey, I like your T-shirt. Yeah, he said, I had it made special. Like, yeah, that's really sharp. We said, well, thank you. No, I mean, it's really unique. It's really different. I said, well, I don't think it was that great. He said, yeah, I think you get home today, you ought to take it off and wash it and save it. Put it in mothballs and save it. He said, well, why do I want to do that? He said, well, I tell you, you're about 22, aren't you? Yeah, I said, I'm 21. He said, well, you know, chances are, the odds are 3 or 4 years you're going to get married. Yeah, he said, I probably will. He said, I bet you anything, you have a little girl. And she's going to be the light of your life. You're going to love her, and you're going to watch her grow up, and someday she's going to go on her first date. And that nervous young man's going to come to the front door to take you, the darling of your life, out on her first date, and you can go get that T-shirt and give it to him. You see, we need to teach our kids that God designed sex to express the marriage relationship, and if we try to use it for anything else, we mess it all up. We lose the joy. And we take the long view of sex. Understand? That is, I said to my boys, I want to teach you how to handle sex, how to control it, how to think about it, so that 20 years from now, it'll be the thing in your life, the joy that God made it to be. But if you mess with it, you can ruin it for life. You can get it all tied up with guilt and disappointment and bad memories and emotional scars. And God didn't make it for grief. He made it for joy. But you got to take the long view. That's smart. Well, I don't want to go into any more except to say one more thing. That men, we must tell our sons that they are responsible. Our culture says that the girls are responsible, and the ethic that was enforced when I was growing up was this, and nobody said it, but everybody thought it. The boy's got a right to get everything he can get, and the girl has to draw the line. And if anything happens, she's a tramp, and he's just being a boy. Girls will be sinners, and boys will be boys. Now listen. I teach my sons that when they take a girl out, they are responsible. You do not put a girl in a position where she has to draw the line. You draw the line. The Bible does not say thou shalt not commit adultery, girls. And it does not talk about the sin of fornication for girls. It is for all. And I think as men in the church, we need to get our sons over that piece of foolishness that says somehow boys have a right to go for it and the girl must be the one who has the morals. Does that make sense to you? Teach our boys that they are responsible. And they'll listen to that. Well, many other things. But we must give them the long view, and we must teach them. We must teach them that the homosexual world isn't gay. It's desolate. We must teach them such things as honor, integrity, responsibility. I tell you, we need to raise up a generation of boys who will be real men, godly men, who will play it straight. I'll tell you, my dad, I think, made some mistakes in raising me, just like I'd make mistakes in raising my boys, my children. But my dad taught me to play it straight. He taught me to keep my word and take responsibility and finish my jobs and play it straight. You understand that? Old-fashioned virtues of manhood, and we're dying for them. Well, that's all I have to say about sex education. I could get into more details, and perhaps you'd like for me to, but because of the nature of our crowd tonight, I will not, and I hope I have not offended anyone. But I think we need to deal with this straight on, and because our kids need to know, and they want to know. Again, I talk about secrets and skills of marriage. Let me talk about some minor things now, just to sort of tie up some loose ends in the few minutes that we have together, and I promise not to keep you too late. Take time to play with your children. Here's the rule. If you do not enter their world when they are small, don't expect them to enter your world when they grow up. Take time, and I think parents do a good job of this. Take time to play with children. I'm not just talking about vacations, but take time to play. You know, I've already mentioned, little girls like to sit on daddy's lap. They need to. Little boys like to wrestle. Little boys like to be chased. You know that? One of the greatest honors you can pay for a little boy is chasing. I mean, you don't see a little boy acts? I mean, he'll torment you to death if you'll just run him down and give him a Dutch rub on his head or tickle him. In my case, I throw him in a dad. You wouldn't, Dad, you can't throw me in the pool. Boy, you know little boys like to wrestle with their dads. You know that? Little boys like to wrestle with their dads. Let me ask you, how many men, Don, I don't want to see a show of hands. I'm just trying to make a point. I mean, how many men, especially the older men, can remember their dad ever getting down on the floor and playing with them? Let me tell you, Dad, something. Your little boys ask you to play guns with them, play cowboy and Indians. You ought to do it if you can. They don't ask just anybody. You know how great an honor it is to be asked to play with a little boy? They don't ask just any other little boy. They don't ask many adults. And if they ask you to come and play guns with me, Daddy, or whatever you're playing, it's a great honor. You ought to do it. Because if you turn them down, they'll quit asking. Our neighbors are still talking about the scene of a grown man in a business suit going through the bushes going, I didn't have time to change clothes because I was on my way to go preach. But I got to be a pretty good shot with my finger, right? Take time to play. Enter their world. My wife's mother, my mother-in-law, as I told you before, died a year ago this past March. She's a great lady. And she was dearly loved by her grandchildren. And one of the primary reasons was she entered their world. When they were little ones growing up, girls and boys, they'd go down to visit grandma and they look forward to a tea party. An old fashioned, and she'd get old, she kept a bunch of old clothes down in the basement, long dresses, and they'd dress up and have a little table with these little dishes and little crackers and little candles, make little cups of tea, and they'd get all dressed and have to go around to the front door and knock, and she'd welcome, they had made up names, big fancy last names, she'd welcome them in. And they'd come in and have a tea party. And I'll tell you, she entered their world. And those, my kids love their grandma. You see, she took them seriously enough to enter their world. You see the point? And I don't know how you do that, but my rule is, let me repeat it. If you don't enter their world when they're young, they're not going to enter yours when they get older. Take time to play. You don't always have time, but we need to take time if we can. And we need time alone with each child. I've already suggested this also in another connection. But let me say this. It takes time to get to know children. Some children are different. My wife taught me this. I keep saying that. She taught me most of what I know. We have a rule, you know, we have a rule at our house is that if you're thinking it, it's our business. does a child have a right to privacy? The answer? Not very much. Now, here's where I part with the experts, but the experts are wrong. Should a child have a right to go in the room and close the door and have time alone? Yes. Should they have their own drawer, their own private stuff? Yes. But that's where it stops. You see, we teach our children that we cannot be their parents if we don't know what they're thinking. And so our rule is, if you're thinking it, it's our business, and you're going to tell us. You tell us now or tell us later. With some kids, my oldest daughter is very easy. She was a born mouth. I mean, she'd come in from being somewhere, a date anywhere, she'd wake us up. And my wife, many times my wife's got out of bed at 11:30 at night when the Angela came in and go and spend 45 minutes or an hour in her room just telling her everything. Mother, I want to tell you. And my wife always knew what she was thinking. This is my wife's ministry in our family. She finds out and tells me. Why'd you tell Daddy? I tell Daddy everything. You know that. And then, boy, this is easy. Then came Leslie, our second daughter. How'd it go, Leslie? Okay. What'd you do? Oh, nothing. Tell me about it. No. Yes. Leave me alone. I see my wife sitting beside the bed and just start questioning her. Well, did you do this? How'd this work out? What'd you think of this? And my wife said, well, you're going to tell me. I'm going to sit here. Do you tell me? Oh, Mother, I don't have to tell you everything. Oh, yes, you do. Just tell me. And she'd ask, and prior, and gradually it'd come out. And Leslie is always glad. She's mad at the beginning and glad at the end. I heard her say to her mother one time, I'm glad you don't give up on me. And the greatest compliment, my second daughter, who's the clam, and she's learned now to talk, because she's going to have to anyway. Might as well get it over with. Just tell. And she said to my mother, I heard her say to my wife one time, she said, I'm going to start writing this stuff down, because I want to raise my daughters the way you raised me. And this is after she'd spent an hour and a half prying information out of her. And I tell you, boys are clammish. Boys are clammish. They don't want to talk. But my wife, she just finds out. Why? Let me tell you this. A lot of parents don't know their kids. We've had teenagers in our house, and my wife knew them better than their own parents knew them. That sounds arrogant to say, but it's the absolute truth. Because the parents didn't have time to sit and pry and ask and dig and find out what's going on in their heart. How can we lead our kids? How can we meet our responsibilities before God if we don't know our kids? And it takes time to get to know our kids. Some takes longer for others than for others. Some you can't get to talk, some you can't get to shut up. And most are somewhere in the middle. Does that make sense to you? We've got to know. We've got to know what they're thinking. Because often, listen, the kids can have misconceptions. They can misunderstand things. They can have heartaches going on. And the time to solve some problems is now. And if you wait, they can't ever be solved. And so we need time alone. Give special attention to children. And I've learned to trust my wife in this. She'll say to me, Adam needs to be talked to. Something's bothering him. Here's what I think it is. I do it. Well, I've learned the hard way. She's always right. And I'll have to go talk to him. I depend very much on my wife for that. She's the communicator. She's good at it, and I'm lousy. So she leads and I follow, and we get to know our kids. Well, you understand that? Any questions on that? I'm just sort of touching on these things and moving along. I'm just going to talk about a couple more things and we're going to quit for the evening. Build on the concept of family. This is the last thing I'll talk about. We have so many things we could cover. But build the concept of family and talk family. I recommend this. Say things like this as you're growing up. Look, we're a family. And because we're a family, this is how we operate. At our house, we call it the system. This is the system. What's the system? In our family, we love each other. We don't hit each other. The rule in our house, the children cannot hit each other. They cannot tear each other down. They cannot abuse each other. Why? That's not our business. That's jerk business. Understand what I talked about this morning? We're not cheap in this house. We raise quality people, and quality families build one another up. We don't tear each other down. We do not bite when they're little, or hit, or criticize. And we take care of each other in this family. Talk family. In our family, we do this. In our family, we operate this way. Talk, and it gives children the security they need. We're a family. Our family operates this way. Think family, talk family, operate family. Kids need it. I need it. And you need it. And one of the things that holds families together is this thing called tradition. Build traditions into your family. Take the time to do it. One of my favorite musicals, as I said before, it was Fiddler on the Roof. And Fiddler on the Roof, The opening song is, what's the significance of the filler on the roof? Well, you see, these are, if you saw the musical, these are Russian Jews whose life is very precarious. The Tsar is making life hard for them. So what they're trying to do is maintain their way of life. And they're like a fiddler on the roof who's trying to scrape out a tune without falling off the roof, which was metaphorical for they were trying to stay on, maintain their life without going under. And what keeps the fiddler on the roof? What gave their lives stability? What enabled them to keep their identity? The answer was traditions. Traditions, tradition. Why do we do this? Why do you always wear your hat in the house? Rev Tevye sings. I don't know, but it's a tradition. And tradition is one of the most important glues that holds a family together. It gives a sense of identity. Big traditions, little traditions. Traditions that very often revolve around holidays and birthdays. And sometimes you can inherit traditions from your grandparents, but sometimes you have to create your own. But it's a part of this thing of thinking family, talking family, being family. We could have a grand hour or two just sharing our traditions. I'm sure you have many. And traditions sometimes happen by accident. I recommend that birthdays be a big thing. Every birthday is a party at our family. Every kid, you make a big fuss, especially you got a big family. Every kid gets a cake, and we get balloons, and we get relatives in, and dad goes broke, and we just... Why? It's a big thing. There are little traditions. We have a tradition at our house that when the daughters turn 13, they get their first dozen roses from their daddy. I said, kids, you girls are something. You're going to get a lot of roses in your life. But I've earned the right to give you the first ones. And God knows I've earned that right with contact lens and tennis shoes, nothing else. At Christmas, Christmas Eve day is our family day. Get up in the morning and go out to breakfast, and we go to the same restaurant, the Top of the World at Disney, Contemporary Hotel. We spend the day together. We go home that night and eat fondue. Do it every year. That's what we do at Christmas. This is our family traditions. It gives, is this making sense to you? It gives a sense of identity. And I'm sure many of you have traditions. But you see, traditions are what is the thing that helps kids know who they are. Because you see, the family needs to be an anchor that will hold firm. A place where, to mix my metaphor somewhat, a place where you can put your foot down. And get a firm. Let me put it this way. I grew up in a farm, and I know what it is to swing an axe. And you want to get hurt, you swing an axe without good footing. You have poor footing and try to swing an axe, and you're going to get hurt. And a lot of kids today are trying to swing the axe, but they got nowhere to put their foot. You understand what I'm saying? They got nowhere to put their foot. And the family is where you put your foot and swing away at life and carve out whatever you're going to be. But you got to have some place to put your foot that won't move. And the family does that. Let me close in a somewhat devotional note, and I really appreciate this. Let me repeat what I said at the beginning. I am not suggesting by holding this clinic that I'm an expert in family. And I know that I have as much to learn from you as you have to learn from me. I just happen to be up here talking. And I know that you all do a pretty good job. I've seen some things. I think you all doing great. And I think you probably messed up some. I say that because I know I've messed up some. But God help us in our families. Family business is the business of giving. And I'm back to where I started. We keep the covenant, and the covenant requires otherness. But one of the great mysteries, see, family life today requires that we stand diametrically opposed to the modern ethic of selfism. And the great secret in this is that the great joy is not seeking things for ourselves. The great joy is in giving. You know, the only statement that Jesus ever made that's recorded, but it's not recorded in the gospel narratives, it's recorded in the book of Acts. He said this, it's more blessed to give than it is to receive. The great joy is not trying to get you to make me happy. The great joy that I have is me making you happy. It's the paradox. It's the mystery. It's the difference between get to and got to. You know, some things in life are get to's and some things are got to's. And I'll close with this. Now, certain things are got to's. You got to go to work sometimes, or you got to carry the garbage out, and you got to go to the dentist. Some things, by their very natures, are get to's. Kind of like kissing your wife. That's a get to. When I go home, I got to kiss my wife. I mean, she expects it. And if I don't, she's going to be mad. And, you know, fella, I'll do what's right. So when I get home tomorrow evening, I got to kiss my wife. You know, see my wife? Listen, I don't got to kiss my wife. I get to kiss my wife. It all depends on how you look at it. It's a get-to. And family is a get-to thing. If you're a daddy, let me say this to you. If you're a daddy, you get to go broke. When my kids lose their contact lenses, that's a story. One of my boys got his contact lens broken in his eye recently. My second daughter had a boyfriend who drank one of her contact lenses. I kid you. If you want to know how it happened, ask me later and I'll tell you. You know how fast cheerleading outfits and running shoes and track, I tell you, I'm getting so anytime anybody says, "Hi, Daddy," I reach for my billfold. Just automatic response, you know. They say, "Hi, Daddy," and I say, "How much?" I'm just very honest with you. I don't have anything. I'm worth something if I die, but alive, I'm not worth a plug nickel. When my kids need contact lenses and shoes and clothes and things, although most of them have had work part-time and bought most of their own clothes when they get to be teenagers, that's a thing I didn't have time to talk about, but one of the many things I didn't have time to talk about. But when they need money, I'm the one who's got to pay. They don't go to the neighbor because he's not family. Understand? They go to me. And I got to pay. It's just true. I do. I've got to. Remember I said earlier, if you're going to have kids, you got to raise them. And we've got them, and they're ours, and I've got to pay. No, I don't. I get to. I get to go broke. And I get to worry when they're out and you hear the sirens. And I get to sweat over their decisions. And it's not a got-to thing, it's a get-to thing. Why? What makes it a get-to thing? Why would I say that I get to pay? The answer is this. Because I get to pay because I get to be daddy. And I get to be loved. You see, it's a family. And a family makes it a get-to thing. Because those kids who come to me with their hand out because they got to have a dollar are the same kids who come with a hug and pick me up when I'm down. You see, the saddest thing in the world is not to belong to anybody. God said, and we started out with this the first night, it's not good to be alone. Sure, right about that. You see, the fact that I get to pay means that I belong to a family. They're mine, and I'm theirs. And I got someplace to go, and I got someplace to put my foot down to swing the axe. And I got people who love me and who'll stand by me, people who need me, and I need them. And I tell you, I may be broke, and I may worry a lot, but if I died tonight, it'd take the undertaker 3 days to get the smile off my face. I mean that. Why? Because it's a great thing to have a family, and you know that, don't you? Your family is worth anything. And so the joy is not in having and saving and getting and keeping. The joy is in giving. And family is the business of giving. and therefore it's the thing of joy. Well, thank you very much for allowing me in this way to be a part of your family. May God bless your family.
Amen.